Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. On pins and needles at the moment. I'll tell you why in a second why I'm on pins and needles at the moment. Jimmy Akin's our guest. It's open forum. You can call and ask about anything you want. 888-318-7884. And a reminder, you don't have to be Catholic to call. The show's called Catholic Answers. But it's not called Catholic Callers. Anybody can call. Even if you're not a religious person and you got a question about why we believe in God or Jesus or anything you want to know, we'll be happy to get you an answer. 888-318-7884. All right, here's why I'm on pins and needles. Because right before the break, Jimmy said he's got an announcement for us. And he said all of us in the radio department are going to like it. Jimmy?
Catholic Answers opens an award-winning opera by an avant-garde European composer.
It sounded like a string of words. I literally don't know what you're talking about.
Well, let's go. I didn't either.
All right.
So there's I won't mention names here, because I don't have permission, but there's a listener of Mysterious World who reached out to me.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm working on this project. It involves a couple of projects. It involves a figure in the history of paranormal research, and I was wondering if you could recommend some resources for me. And I knew about this figure, so I recommended some resources. Also, he said he appreciated Mysterious World a lot. He's personally Protestant, but he liked the show a lot. And so then he emails me back and says, so I recently made contact with this European composer named Frederick Acquaviva. And he turns out to be an avant-garde composer, so he does non-traditional music and so forth. But he's written this opera called Antipodes, and it is inspired in some ways by Dante's Divine Comedy. So it's like in three movements. There's a movement for hell, a movement for purgatory, and a movement for paradise. And he sent me a link to where I could listen to it and said I should listen to it. And so I listened, and for like the first several minutes of it, because this is avant-garde, remember, it's not traditional music, it uses found audio footage of Catholic Answers Live. And it's so...
What?
Yeah, so I'm the primary person who's answering a question or set of questions. And I don't know if this was one of our weird question shows or not, but it certainly sounds weird taken out of context. But I'm answering questions about God and Mars and the creation of the universe and what happens to people in the afterlife. And you can also hear your voice chiming in occasionally, Cy. The gentleman who alerted me to this suggested that since I'm kind of the guiding voice at the beginning of the Divine Comedy here, I'm kind of in the Virgil role.
Yeah, yeah.
Because Virgil, the poet, Roman poet Virgil, was the one who guided Dante through the three realms, and or at least the first two. And so I thought that was fascinating. This opera, it's not a traditional opera, but this opera has actually won a prestigious European award for avant-garde radio performances. And so Catholic Answers Live opens an award-winning avant-garde opera.
I am stunned by that news. I got to find this opera. So
I'll send you a link.
Okay. And the name of the composer is again?
Frederick Acquaviva, if I'm recalling correctly.
Frederick Acquaviva. Well, obviously a genius. I mean, I've already decided that. So now the next thing is to listen to his work. Wow, that is at once really utterly unexpected. Like you would not, of all the things I thought, what is Jimmy going to make an announcement about? A avant-garde opera wasn't even on the list, Jimmy.
I was surprised too. I wrote the gentleman back and said, "Wow, I was opening an award-winning opera, and I had no idea."
I know, I know. So it's both the most surprising thing, but also really delightful. Like that is just great news. I love that we're opening an avant-garde opera. You and me, Jimmy. Maybe we can go
based
on the road
on the Divine
together.
Comedy.
Yes. All right, Virgil. Congratulations, Virgil. Wow. 888-318-7884 is the number. Call with your questions about anything you want to ask about, especially opera, because We've been in one. We know a lot about that. Michael, in Pittsburgh,
Pennsylvania. I actually do know a lot about certain operas, especially the ones written by Gilbert and Sullivan.
Oh, you love those Gilbert and Sullivan.
Yep.
Oh, now I was just going to do a quote from Gilbert and Sullivan, and I couldn't think of one. Give me one. Give me some Gilbert and Sullivan.
Most ingenious paradox.
Ah, okay. There we go. What's the one from the Major General? What's the...
I am the very model of a modern Major General. I've information, vegetable, animal, and mineral. I know the kings of England, and I quote the fights historical from Marathon to Waterloo in order categorical. And I'll stop there, although I could go on.
Well, you're an opera star now. You can sing for as long as you want. You can take the whole hour if you want, Jimmy.
I'm not a diva.
No, you're not an opera diva. Michael in Pittsburgh, thanks for waiting, Michael. Watching on YouTube, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Well, this was good timing because I'm actually a professional opera singer, so it was really cool to hear about.
Are you familiar with the works of Mr. Acquaviva?
Actually, no, but it's not surprising that such a work would come out of Germany. They're usually on the cutting edge of
the
avant-garde opera scene.
Yeah, it's Wagner and then Acquaviva.
I actually sing mostly like Wagner and German Rep Strauss stuff like that.
Yeah. Ah, I am one of those people who learn my my Wagner from Bugs Bunny. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Do you remember Bugs Bunny? Kill the wabbit, kill the wabbit. That was yeah.
I have read the Ring cycle by Wagner.
And I watched Bugs Bunny. So go ahead, Michael, with your question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, well, my question does have to do with opera, but it does have to do with saints. I'm curious when the Catholic Church started making people saints, like what's the origin of that? And also, I've always been curious why Michael the Archangel, who's an angel and not a human, is referred to as Saint Michael and obviously is also a saint, even though he's not human.
Okay. So the term that is used in Latin for a saint is sanctus, and it simply means holy. Anything that is holy can be described in Latin as sanctus. And the Greek equivalent is hagios. And so from biblical times, there have been references, and there are also Hebrew and Aramaic equivalents, but I won't go into them. But from biblical times, it has been common to describe various things and people as holy. And in so you would have references to human beings as holy. You see that in the New Testament, where like Paul is writing to his letters to people, and he refers to the Christians in the churches he's writing to as saints or holy ones. They're holy ones of God. In the Old Testament, the Israelites, being God's people, they were a people that was holy to God. And so the Israelites were also holy ones. God himself is holy, as we hear in the Trisagion, the thrice holy, 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 holy is the Lord God of hosts. So God is the Holy One of Israel. Jesus is described as the Holy One of God. And the angels who stuck by God's side are called the holy angels. And there are also other things that are holy, like the temple is God's holy house. Moses stands on holy ground and various things like that. So anything that so it was just a normal part of biblical culture to refer to various people and things as holy. And when the church began to grow into Latin speaking areas, the Latin term sanctus came to be used for these same things. So you would have a reference to Michael as Holy Michael or Sanctus Michael, which then became, in English, Saint Michael. You'd have references to Holy Peter and Holy Paul, Sanctus Petrus and Sanctus Paulus, which in English became Saint Peter and Saint Paul. And originally, these were just popular acclamations. If people regarded someone as holy, they'd refer to them as holy so-and-so. And eventually, the church started to formalize the process. It began with local bishops making determinations for their diocese about whether a given person should be referred to as holy or not. And eventually, the Pope took over the process. As the church became more interconnected, the the Holy See wanted there to be standardization in who was legitimately regarded as holy and who was not. But that's kind of how the overall process evolved. And because Michael is one of the holy angels, he became known as Saint Michael, because, or Holy Michael, because he is a holy angel. What a lot of people don't realize is, because we have this dual English vocabulary, it comes partly from Latin roots and partly from German roots, the connection between these two concepts is often obscured. Sanctus and saint comes, sanctus is a Latin word, and saint comes from that Latin root. Holy, though, comes from German roots. The German equivalent is Heiliger. And because we have these two different words for the same concepts, our Bibles in English will sometimes use the word saint and sometimes use the word holy. And that can cause us to not realize that when Jesus is described as the Holy One of God, you could equally well translate that Jesus is the Saint of God. And when God is described as the Holy One of Israel, you could equally well translate that as God is the Saint of Israel. And so that's a basic sketch of the issue.
Michael, okay?
Yeah, okay. So you're basically saying that some people, like, you know, St. Peter, St. Paul, were kind of grandfathered in, and then later actually canonizing people became something that, like, happened later over the centuries, and it became more like a solid process.
Yes, exactly. It became progressively more formal.
Formal process, yes. Okay. Great. Thank you.
All right, Michael, thank you. Can I ask you a question before you go?
Sure.
Has the COVID and all that really upset the opera world? Have you been able to sing or no?
Yeah, actually, I was living in New York City where I got my master's degree, and I ended up moving back to Pittsburgh, moving back home, and have been in semi-retirement for the past, couple years, kind of waiting for things to open up. But there are opera companies, including the Pittsburgh Opera. I just saw the Magic Flute a couple months ago, and I'll see Carmen in the spring. So there are operas happening. I just haven't quite gotten back into it yet.
Gotcha.
I'm kind of waiting for things to calm down. Like, maybe wait till there isn't another variant. Like Omicron.
Well, that day might never come, Michael, but good luck with that.
I know, but I'm kind of waiting it out.
Thank you. It was fortuitous that you were the first caller after the announcement that Jimmy made about us being part of an opera. For anybody who, I like to give our scholarly citations. So I looked it up, and the opera, the Wagner opera, Bugs Bunny, it's called What's Opera, Doc? 1957 short from Warner Brothers. Right back with more Open Forum.
This is Bishop Chad Zielinski from the Diocese of Fairbanks of Northern Alaska, and you are listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
How should we pray? The disciples asked our Lord that question, and he gave them the Our Father, or the Lord's Prayer. But he also gave them the liturgy, which is the most privileged form of prayer in the Catholic tradition, especially the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass. We can pray with the whole church in the liturgy of the hours, or the Divine Office, and we should also pray in our own private room, our secret chamber, as Jesus says, and then our Father who sees us in secret will reward us.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Thanks for being with us. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's open forum, so you can ask whatever you want. But Carrie gave me this today, and I knew this was coming, but I just want to read it to you verbatim. I'm not going to ad-lib this one, because I want you to know I'm really excited about this. Everyone here at Catholic Answers is, and that is excited to share. that the Catholic Answers apologists are now on the Hallo app, answering our most frequently asked Catholic Answers questions. Hallo is the number one Catholic app in the world for audio-guided prayer, meditation, Catholic music, and audio Bible readings. Unfortunately, no avant-garde opera, but it's still a very good app. In addition to the Catholic Answers apologists, the app features guests sessions and prayers from your favorite Catholic speakers, including Father Mike Schmitz, Dr. Scott Hahn, and many more. With over 3,000 different prayers and meditations, you can deepen your relationship with God and your understanding of the beautiful prayer and meditation traditions of the Church, such as Lectio Divina, Rosary, Examen, Daily Saint Reflection. You can listen to Catholic Answers apologists and try all of the prayers and meditations on Hallo for free by creating an account at hallo.com/Catholic Answers. Do it today. Deepen your faith. That's really exciting. That Hallo app is really taking off. Let's go to Scott in New Jersey now, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Scott, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you, guys. Blessing to be on. So my wife is pregnant, due in 2 weeks.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Prayers would be appreciated. So I wanted to get her something nice, maybe spoil her. And the traditional thing is get like the birthstone, one of those, you know, month of the year things. And the question came up, is that, what are the roots of that? Is it pagan? Where did it come from? Is it something that Catholics should avoid or not?
Okay, so let's suppose that we had evidence that birthstones were of pagan origin. Why would that be a problem?
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
I have no idea.
Okay, good, because there is no reason why it should be a problem. As long as you're not worshiping pagan gods or being tempted to worship pagan gods or anything like that, you're not engaged in paganism. There's nothing wrong with these stones. I mean, whether it's a ruby or an emerald or a peridot or whatever it may be, there's nothing wrong with the stones. God created them. And so they're part of God's material creation. They're there for the use of humans. And if it makes you happy to have a particular stone, or would make your wife happy to have a particular stone, that's fine. That's just using God's creation. So that's not a problem. If pagans happen to do it first, who cares? And so it wouldn't matter. Now, having made that point, it's not pagan in origin. It's actually rooted in biblical practices. There are 12 months in the year. Each one has a birthstone, so there are 12 different stones. Now, Sykelet, can you think of anyone in the Bible who had a collection of 12 different stones? And this may not be super easy to get, but
I thought you were going to go with suns, 12 suns. So
nope, 12 signs. 12 suns could be a clue here, but it happens to be 12 stones, 12 different stones, on which, give you a clue, on which the names of the sons of Israel were written.
I'm thinking of the book of Revelation right now. And the,
no, think the other end of the Bible.
Oh. You got to help me, Jimmy. I'm completely lost.
The Jewish high priest. Oh. He had a breastpiece that had 12 stones on it with the names of the 12 tribes of Israel written on them. So he would bear the names of the 12 tribes when he would go before the Lord in the temple. And believe it or not, that appears to be the origin of birthstones, because we proceed along through the Bible. Now, what you were thinking of, no doubt, is in the book of Revelation, where John sees the names of the 12 apostles written on the foundations of the 12 foundations of the New Jerusalem.
That's what I was thinking of, yes.
Yep. Well, apparently, Christians later combined these ideas and started associating these different stones with the 12 apostles. It's based on the earlier breastpiece of the high priest, but then in the Christian age, Christians, especially in the Middle Ages, they wrote a lot about stuff in nature, including stones. I've read, and not all of their ideas are scientifically valid, at least according to current science. Like, for example, I was reading in Hildegard of Bingen, she says that emeralds can cure epilepsy. So if you have someone who's having an epileptic fit, you put an emerald in their mouth and they'll get better. But in talking about and writing about nature, they didn't just cover what we would consider the scientific or medical aspects. They also assigned things religious values. They used things in nature as religious symbolism. And so, for example, the pelican is in medieval writing is a symbol of Christ, because it was believed that the pelican, and this is based on the fact that the interior of a pelican's mouth is red in color, it was thought that pelicans would feed their chicks their own blood, like Christ feeds us his own blood. And so pelicans became a symbol of Christ. Well, in the Middle Ages, they also started associating different birthstones or different stones with the 12 apostles. And since there are 12 months in the year, it was natural to say, okay, let's kind of associate these with the calendar as well. And that's where the custom of having birthstones came from. Now, which particular stones are assigned with particular months has varied over time. But in the early 20th century, there was an effort by the gem industry to standardize that. And So our modern, it's kind of like Mother's Day was invented by the greeting card industry so they could sell cards. Well, the gem industry didn't want confusion about if you want to celebrate someone who was born in this month, what stone should you buy? So they kind of standardized them. But ultimately, it seems to go back to the fact that the high priest had these 12 stones on his breastpiece with the names of the 12 tribes on them. That led into an association of the different gemstones with the 12 apostles, and that led into an association with the calendar.
So, Scott, how does that make you feel?
Oh, wow. That's a lot of information. I'm always amazed at how much you guys know. Yeah, that was great. Thank you very much.
Well, Scott, by way of congratulations, I'd like to send you one of Jimmy Akin's books. What do you think the baby would prefer, the Bible is a Catholic book or a Daily Defense?
Ooh, Daily Defense, please. Thank you.
You were so right. Babies love a Daily Defense. That is one of their favorites. It's big with the babies.
Believe it or not, I have received multiple pictures on social media of people of their babies holding a Daily Defense and sometimes chewing on it.
So, Scott, there you go. You've got that. You know, when you asked the question, Jimmy, I just couldn't get off of Jacob and his 12 sons.
They're tied into that.
Yeah.
Jacob is Israel, so Israel's 12 sons.
I kept thinking, did Jacob have a stone for each son? And I couldn't think, all right, well, we got it. Scott, again, thanks very, very much for the call. Let's go to Cyrus in Virginia Beach, Virginia, watching on Twitch. Cyrus, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, just had a quick question. I was reflecting on the state of how, following the final judgment, God would create a new heaven and a new earth. And I was reflecting the other day about, whenever I dialogue with atheists, one of the most common objections is, well, I can't find God anywhere, to which the obvious answer is God exists out of time and space. My question was, if there is going to be a new creation and we would be with God fully, how can we be with him if he's going to be outside of time and space, but the new creation would be decidedly inside of space?
So the answer is that we will be with God in a spiritual way, not a physical way. So we will have what theologians refer to as the beatific vision, which is a spiritual perception of God. Now, in this life, we don't ordinarily, unless God is giving us a vision, a revelation, we don't have an awareness of God in our ordinary. I mean, we may think about God, but we don't perceive God in any direct way in this life under ordinary circumstances. But in the final state of mankind, we will have a form of spiritual enlightenment that allows us to perceive God through our intellects as a kind of intellectual vision, and it will be a form of spiritual union. But that does not mean that God will be extended in space and time apart from the incarnation of his Son, Jesus Christ, because his Son does have a body that is extended in space and time, and we will be united with Jesus. And St. Paul says in 1 Thessalonians 4 that in the final state, we will always be with Jesus.
Let me check it and see if that works for Cyrus. Does that make sense to you, Cyrus?
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to say congratulations on the opera. I was just going to say, if you're a Virgil, does that make Trent Horn and a Beatrice? Do we have that to look forward to as well?
I'm afraid that that the composer would have to answer the question of whether Trent Horn plays the role of Beatrice.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, and I got to say, I'm hoping Trent's not in it. I'd like to have something Trent's. I just one thing Trent's not involved in. I don't mean it, Trent. I'm only kidding. We'll be right back with more Open Forum, Catholic Answers Live.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. It's free, and you'll have instant access to our daily broadcast, the schedule of upcoming shows, and you'll even be able to search the archive and listen to thousands of past shows. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Most of us Catholic parents agree our number one goal in life is to pass on the faith to our children. But here's the bad news. Today's world has a million ways to steal your kid's soul. Don't be afraid, says Father Sebastian Walsh. God loves your children even more than you do, and he desires their salvation more than anything. In his groundbreaking new book, Always a Catholic, Father Walsh shows you how to cooperate with God to bring about the fulfillment of his will for your kids. Always a Catholic reminds us that keeping our kids in the faith is about the way we live our Catholicism in our own lives and as a family from day to day. Order your copy of Always a Catholic by visiting shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Tomorrow on More to Life, R-E-S-P-E-C-T.
Is disrespect disrupting your relationships? We'll help you get the respect you need.
That's tomorrow on More to Life. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, opera star, our guest. It's Open Forum. You're welcome to call with any question you've got. 888-318-7884. Lines have been pretty busy today, but every now and then one opens up and you can get in. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. I see Ethan in Cincinnati, Ohio is next, watching on YouTube. Ethan, before I put you on the air, I'm just going to say this. First of all, I need somebody took the line. Oh, no, it's line six. Okay, Ethan, it's a family show, so just be careful how you phrase your question, but go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Okay, so my question for Jimmy Akin is, what is the Church's teaching on marital rape as opposed to, like, you know, rape? Like,
well, I don't know of a magisterial document. I think there probably is a magisterial document that addresses the question directly, but I don't know it off the top of my head. What I can say is that Catholic moral theology would abhor marital rape as well as rape, the use of force, whether physical or otherwise, to compel a person to engage in the marital act with you is morally repugnant. And the marital act is meant to be an act of love, and it contravenes love to force someone into this situation against their will, whether you're doing that through physical force or emotional force or whatever it may be. Now, it takes on an additional aspect of evil when you're doing this with someone you're not even married to. But it is still gravely, gravely wrong to do it with someone you are married to. And so so Catholic moral theology would absolutely reject this. The spouses do have an obligation to fulfill their marital duties to each other, but that doesn't mean you can use force to achieve that fulfillment.
Okay, Ethan?
Yes, sir.
All makes right. Sense. Thank you, sir. And you did a good job with that question, Ethan. Thanks for the directness of it. Let's go to Isaac in Virginia now, watching on YouTube. Isaac, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yeah. I found on Christian book distributors something of a... It's a reprinting of a Bible that's from the 1300s called Wycliffe's Bible.
Uh-huh. Isaac, are you there?
Yes, actually. It says there's a page that shows it from Fox's Book of Martyrs that Wycliffe's bones were dug up and then burned and thrown in a river.
So are you wondering if a Catholic can read Wycliffe's Bible, if that's how he's seen it in the Protestant world? Is that the question, Isaac?
That's one of them.
Oh, well, let's start there. I'll come. Did you want to give me the other one now?
Yeah. Answer them in order, but why was his bones dug up and burned?
Ah, gotcha. Okay, I see.
So I'd have to do some checking to refresh my memory on whether that actually happened. But if it did, it would be because Wycliffe, and it can be pronounced different ways. Some people pronounce it Wycliffe, some people pronounce it Wycliffe. Really doesn't matter. John Wycliffe was a figure in England prior to the time of the Protestant Reformation, but in some ways he anticipated certain aspects of the Reformation. And he was the leader of a movement that became known as the Lollards, and he and the Lollards were opposed to various things in the church, including they didn't really approve of or get along with the Pope. And if after his death, Wycliffe was subject to a kind of post-mortem humiliation by having his bones burned up and dug, it would be because he was the leader of the Lollards, and they were regarded as a very problematic group. And back in the past, if people really didn't like you, they might do stuff like that to your body or your bones after you were dead, just to really underscore the point, we didn't like this person. So that would be the basic reason for why that would be. In terms of reading Wycliffe's Bible, well, there's certainly no prohibition on it. And, you know, it is not the earliest English version of the Bible, but it is an early version. It predates the King James and the Bishop's Bible and other early English versions. And it had an influence on later English translations because, you know, if you're translating the Bible, it's kind of a big task, and you're looking at some hard to read, hard to understand phrase in Greek or Hebrew, and you say, I wonder how other people have done this and how they translated this phrase. And so you might look in, if you're an early English Bible translator, you would look at earlier versions of the English Bible, including Wycliffe's. And so it is an influential Bible in the history of English translations. There's nothing in principle wrong with reading it. It's not going to be perfect. It's not going to be based on modern scholarship. It may have some theological biases that it shouldn't have, but there's nothing in principle wrong with it. wrong with reading it as long as you know your faith and you exercise critical thinking when you read this or any other book. I would mention, though, that because of the period in which it was written, this is it's basically going to be like late Middle English. It's not going to be easy to read.
But maybe you're skilled in that. Isaac, thanks very much for the call. I hope that was helpful to you. Thank you. Lots and lots of folks on the line. Going to keep moving. I'm going to go to Buffalo, New York now. Theodore in Buffalo, also watching on YouTube. Theodore, glad to have you. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, guys. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. My question actually pertains to Jimmy's book, The Daily Defense, which was actually mentioned earlier by one of your previous callers. I have been experiencing a lot of my friends. They're not as in the faith as I am. And I was wondering, is this book very helpful for helping me like explain my beliefs in a calm way and like help persuade them and like help me, like, you know, give them the other side of things?
Yeah, in fact, it's to a significant extent, that's what a daily defense is designed to do. Because in conversations with non-Catholics, including non-Christians and atheists, they will raise various objections to or challenges to the Christian faith and to the Catholic faith. And so each page of this book has a challenge at the top of the page. It's typically stated in just a sentence or two, but it's the kind of thing that that someone objecting to the faith might raise in conversation. And then it has a very brief, just one page long reply to the challenge. And it's meant to help people both inform themselves, but also be prepared to interact in conversations with people who raise such challenges. What the book doesn't do is like present a positive systematic account of here's a bunch of evidence that I would offer in favor of the faith if I was going to give a lecture on it. It's more designed to handle particular challenges that will come up in conversations. So it actually is quite well suited for conversational apologetics.
Theodore?
Oh, yeah, thanks. I'll have to, I'll have to look into getting it.
Well, let me tell you something, Theodore. Jimmy didn't say it, but I would also recommend if you just want a good preparation to have the words to talk about the faith, Jimmy's book, The Words of Eternal Life, is very helpful in that regard. It gives you a kind of a way to talk about the faith with anyone you want to talk about.
Making the positive case rather than responding to challenges.
Right, right. So I think I'd like you to have both of those books. And if you want to hang on the line, we'll send them to you, Theodore. We can send mail to Buffalo, New York. You're on the right side of the border. Just hang on and we'll send you A Daily Defense and Words of Eternal Life. And then maybe call back and tell us what you think sometime. As long as it's positive, don't call back and tell us if you have a negative experience like it got lost in the mail. 888-318-7884 is the number. Christian, right here in California. Listening on the podcast. Go ahead, Christian, with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, can you hear me?
Barely. There we go.
Thank you for taking my call, by the way.
Yeah, thanks for getting in the same car with the phone. go ahead with your question. I don't know why you were in the other car.
I believe my question was kind of answered with the last caller. My older brother, he's atheist, and he always brings up the kind of topic of how he doesn't really see faith, or I'm sorry, logic in the faith. And it's kind of hard for me to explain that I see the logic, but I see it with my faith. So my question was kind of like, how could I kind of defend my faith in that sense? With someone who is atheist or would bring up that kind of rebuttal to me.
When he says that he doesn't see logic in the faith, does he mean that there's no logic at all or just that he is not persuaded by the logic he's heard?
Yeah, he sees that kind of it's not something that would seem real to him because the way he looks at it is kind of like, these are all things that people tell you just to kind of make you feel better. It's not something that actually happened in history.
Okay, well, there are various ways of approaching that. One is by showing him historical evidence. And there are a variety of different ways. Now, it's what will help him is going to depend on who he is and what, how much he's willing to invest in figuring this out. I mean, if he's not going to listen, then there's not really much you can do to help. But if he would, for example, be willing to read a book or something like that that discusses the historical reliability of the New Testament, there are any number of books I could recommend. A short one that is something of a classic is by the British scholar F.F. Bruce, like in Bruce Wayne. So F.F. Bruce, it's called The New Testament Documents, Are They Reliable? A somewhat longer book is by the American scholar Craig Blomberg, B-L-O-M-B-E-R-G. It's called the Historical Reliability of the Gospels. And a very recent book, a very recent second edition of a book that's really great. It's a little bit longer, but it's called Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. It is by the British scholar Richard Baucham, B-A-U-C-K-H-A-M, and it is outstanding. I recommend that to anybody who's interested in the reliability of the Gospels and are they based on eyewitness testimony and things like that. Now, there are obviously other things that someone coming from an atheist perspective would have that they would wonder about, like how do we know that God exists and things like that. Both A Daily Defense and The Words of Eternal Life and other things will help with that. But specifically in terms of is there a historical basis for the Christian faith, I would recommend the three books I just mentioned. The New Testament Documents, Are They Reliable? By F.F. Bruce. The Historical Reliability of the Gospels by Craig Blomberg. And Jesus and the Eyewitnesses by Richard Baucham.
Okay, Christian.
Okay, thank you so much. I'll look into those books.
All right, great. Thank you. And you sound like a very good brother, Christian.
By the way, if you go to youtube.com/JimmyAiken, which is my YouTube page, I recently, this is in the last couple of months, I posted about a 20-minute talk I did on Are the Gospels, Did Jesus Exist, and Can We Trust the Gospels? And it's a very basic presentation because I only have 20 minutes. But if you go to youtube.com/JimmyAiken, you should be able to find that. And maybe he'd be willing to invest 20 minutes to look at a brief presentation.
Okay, thank you so much. I'll look into that too.
All right. Thank you again, Christian. We have to take a break. Right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Aiken.
Hello, this is Archbishop Alexander Sample of the Archdiocese of Portland in Oregon. Keep that dial right here on Catholic Answers Live.
St. John Paul II stated that, for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation.
So we know we're called, but how do we do it?
St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
Don't you feel sometimes like there's so many people in the world, how does he hear your prayer? Never think of that, huh? Everybody thinks of that. I'm only a little grain of sand on the seashore. Oh, but that's not true. See, God is God. And you and I have to let God be God. I don't know how he does it. He's God.
For more information on Mother Angelica, visit Religious Catalog at EWTNRC.com.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. I was just sad that there was no groovy music, but it's not Thursday. Thursday is groovy music day. I guess I just got conditioned to when Jimmy's on, we hear it. Let's go to Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Michael, listening to EWTN on channel 130, Sirius XM satellite radio. Glad to have you, Michael. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi there. Mike calling from the wrong side of the border. I apologize. I'm driving from Ottawa to Toronto in a snowstorm.
I didn't mean wrong side of the border. That came off wrong when I said Buffalo was on the right
kidding,
side.
I'm kidding.
I just mean we can't mail to Canada.
That's all right. That's right. So, yeah, I had a quick question. The sons of Noah, so Shem, Japheth, and Ham, and I think I've understood that some of the rabbinical teachings, maybe in the Talmud, which contains some pretty bad things we don't want to talk about, but also some, I guess, insightful works of the rabbis, that the darker complexion people of the world in the southern sort of hemisphere may be descendants of Ham, that the Shemitic people are the descendants of Shem, and that Europeans may be sort of the descendants of Japheth. And for some reason, I just intuitively thought, I wonder if I've always sort of trifurcated the academia into, the natural sciences and then the social sciences and then I guess sort of theology. And I found somewhere, I don't know where, in Google land, something that validated my hunch and sort of said that, yes, the descendants of Shem were given the gift of sort of theology, and the descendants of Japheth were given the gift of sort of philosophy, and the descendants of Ham were given sort of the gift of technology, which, helped them spread across the earth and understand how to work with nature and create boats across the Pacific and all that sort of thing. I never found it again. So did I dream that, or is there such a thing as that? And then I wanted somehow to parlay that to the three languages written on the crucifix, so Latin, Greek, and I don't know, it was Aramaic or Hebrew. You would think that if one of those groups were adept at philosophy, you think it would probably be the Greeks. Clearly, the Aramaic would be the Shemites. So the Greeks would be the descendants of the Japheth. The Aramaic or Hebrew would be obviously the Shemites. So would that mean that the Latin would correspond to Hamites?
All right,
just,
So let me first, I want to make sure I understand your question, the first part of your question. We'll get to the titulum on the cross. But regarding the first part of your question, you said you saw on some web page that you found an assertion. Tell me if I'm wrong, if I misheard this, that according to rabbinic thought, the different ethnic groups stemming from Noah's three sons were given various gifts or aptitudes regarding particular things. And could you refresh my memory on what things were allegedly ascribed to which groups?
Like the Hamites were given, were made adept at, let's say technology, understanding creation, but not, the level of the rational soul, but, like a scientist, right? Looking at molecules and biology and that sort of thing, which enabled them to go forth and conquer the earth. But I forget the saying, but the Hamites, when Noah, I don't know what.
Okay.
When he cursed Ham's son or something like that. The Japhethites would have been given philosophy, and the Semites would have been given something akin to theology.
Okay. Well, I haven't read the Talmud from front to back, so I'm not familiar with this passage. I would have loved to read it, but it's so lengthy that there are actual stories, and these are probably apocryphal, of people being killed when a set of the Talmud fell on them. Because it is really massive. And I'm not familiar with this claim. It wouldn't particularly surprise me if the Talmud or any other source in this historical period had speculations about the differences between the different ethnic groups that came from Noah's sons. And it wouldn't particularly surprise me if there was an effort to look at the observed differences in their day and say, so we Jewish people, we're Semites, and we've got the right theology, so we had that as a gift. And the Japhethites, who are regarded as being the ancestors of Europeans, well, the Greeks are really good philosophers, so maybe You know, that's one of the gifts that Japhethites had. But the thing is, any such speculation is not going to be reliable. There is nothing in the Bible that discusses the different groups having different gifts. They're you know, they all come from the same father. They all come from the same culture. And there are no prophecies in the Bible saying, "And I'm going to give one of them special gifts." The only one that we were told anything prophetic about is Canaan. And that reflects the fact that the Canaanites, via Ham, but that reflects the fact that the Canaanites were the original inhabitants of the Promised Land, which was then inherited by the Israelites, and they subjected the Canaanites to servitude. And that's what that reflects. But if people in some later age are looking around at ethnic groups in their own day, it's not going to be reliable as a sign of you know, God caused this or means this to always be the case. Yeah, Greeks did have a lot of really great philosophy at various points in their history. They're still, I'm sure, quite good Greek philosophers today, but they're not the major philosophical driving forces in the world of philosophy today, which I know something about because my academic training is in philosophy. And really, the you know, other nations have come to the fore, like France and Germany and America and Britain and places like that. And today, philosophy is a global enterprise, but the Greeks don't particularly dominate in philosophy today. And so it's easy to speculate based on what you see around you in a particular historical period, but it's really a mistake to try to say, oh, and this is always going to be the case, or this is a matter of divine law or something like that. So fundamentally, all human beings are equal in God's eyes, and any particular inclinations that are had in a particular age are going to be things that may be true in that age, but are more matters of culture than anything else. In terms of the titulum on the cross, well, it was written in these three languages, Greek, Latin, and Aramaic, or Hebrew possibly, but Aramaic really, in all likelihood. And so Aramaic is a Semitic language, and so that ties it to the Semites, but both Latin and Greek are Indo-European languages. They both are belong to the same language family. In fact, there are a lot of words in Greek that are the same as in Latin. You know, I mean, you may pronounce them a little bit differently, but pater in Greek means pater in Latin, and they both mean father in English. And similarly, mater in Greek means mater in Latin, and they both mean mother in English. And so Greek and Latin are coming from the same language family. They're both descended from the Indo-European language stock. And if you try mapping that onto the sons of Noah, they're both going to end up being Japhethites, according to the common reckoning. Not that we should rely on that reckoning, but that's the way they would have been reckoned in the ancient world. Hebrews would have looked at Greeks and Romans and said, yeah, they're both descendants of Japheth. So there doesn't really seem to be a representative of a Hamitic language on the titulum.
Michael, I think I better leave it there because we are approaching the end. I hope that was helpful to you. Thanks for calling from Toronto on the right side of the border. Depending on which way you're looking at the map, could be the left side if you're looking at it the other way. Appreciate that. Go ahead. Did you want to say something else, Jimmy?
Well, I was going to say we've got kids tend to be real direct in their questions, and there could be time to answer a child's question coming up if we happen to have one on line one.
All right. We'll go to Blaze. Blaze, can you ask Jimmy? Hey, Blaze.
Blaze's question was, when you go to heaven, are there going to be books, and will that give you satisfaction? There may or may not be books, but we will have all the knowledge we want and need. And so we will have satisfaction in what we know.
Blaze, thanks. You want to ask a follow-up? Maybe call back on Thursday. That would be. I'm sorry I didn't get to you, Blaze. Thanks for everybody who called. Thank you to you, Jimmy Akin. Appreciated those 2 hours.
My pleasure.
And I believe what the only appropriate thing to do is to give the closing salutation in opera, because Jimmy and I are now opera stars, if you heard the beginning of the show. So here it is, the operatic version of the conclusion of the show. No, I can't do it. Sorry. See you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Stage Fright.
Life.